Welcome to Nobody Told Me.
I'm Laura Owens.
And I'm Jan Black.
We're a mother-daughter duo who have had the same kinds of conversations that most parents have with their kids as they grow up. Issues related to school and family, goals, misunderstandings, and expectations we have all come up for us over the years. We've had some great, meaningful conversations, and I think we would both admit some meltdowns too.
Maybe one or two, but anyhow, all parents want to keep their kids safe, healthy, happy, and motivated, but sometimes it's hard to know what to say to achieve those goals. Conversation between parents and kids can be difficult at times, if not impossible. That's why we're excited to welcome neuropsychologist William Stixrud and test prep expert Ned Johnson to the show. They are the authors of the best-selling book, The Self-Driven Child, and they have a new book out called What Do You Say? How to Talk with Kids to Build Motivation, Stress Tolerance, and a Happy Home. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us.
Wonderful to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
What is the story behind the title of the book, What Do You Say?
Well, the story is that in our first book, The Self-Driven Child, we have some dialogues in there. We have some language that we found to be successful. And parents just wanted to know more of that. What do I say? I can't keep trying to tell my kid, you know, I've told him a million times, or, you know, I don't know how to talk to him about this. So Ned and I have been talking with kids one-on-one for probably a total of about 65 years combined. And we figured let's just share a lot more of the language that we use to help kids basically find their own motivation, the way we communicate to kids that helps them develop what we call high stress tolerance, or that ability to function well in stressful situations and not be overwhelmed. And also communicate in a way that just lowers the temperature at home. Things are more comfortable and happy.
You guys say that energy has a huge impact on our interactions and how positive they are. So can you give us an example of how that would be good with good energy and bad with bad energy?
Yeah. So let's take typical things like what happened or what were you thinking? Which, if we're honest with ourselves, are really accusations with question marks at the end, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to, do you know what happened there? It's curious, it's inquisitive, it's warm, it's supportive, as opposed to what happened there. So much of what we talk about in the book is the what and the words, but also a lot of the how. The first chapter in our book, it talks about the value and the how-to of establishing empathy, connection, showing respect, so that we really open the door so the kids are receptive to the advice, the wisdom, the advice, the support that we as parents, you know, want and know how to give.
You say that instead of thinking of yourself as your parents' boss or manager, that you should think of yourself as their consultant. Elaborate on that a little bit, because I think that's a great mind shift that can really help.
You know, as a neuropsychologist, I test kids who have ADHD or learning disabilities, emotional problems or social problems. And I was struck early in my career by how many parents say, God, I just dread dinner time, because after dinner, it's 3 hours of fighting with my kid about his homework. And so I suggested years ago to the parents to say, I love you too much to fight with you about your homework. And I'm willing to help you any way I can. I'm willing to be your homework consultant, but I'm not willing to be the boss or to act like somehow I'm supposed to be able to make you do your homework. I couldn't make you do it. And we found that this kind of metaphor, thinking of yourself is not the all-knowing person who always knows what's best, but is the person whose job it is to help the kid figure out what kind of life he or she wants and how to pursue it. And it just seems that our goal is for kids to be able to run their own life by the time they leave home. I mean, we see so many kids who go start college in their home by November. They just aren't ready to really manage the challenges of being in college and running their life. And so we think that this perspective from the time they're pretty young, perspective of we're guides, you know, we're consultants to our kids, helping them figure out what's important to you. What do you want to work hard at? Is there a way that I can help?
And if I can add to that, if you think about a business consultant, right, this person is knowledgeable about the ways of business and people in the world, but doesn't know the ins and outs of any person's business as much as that person does themselves. But what a good consultant will do will ask questions. And have you tried this? Do you think that would happen? I wonder what would happen if you tried this. In my experience, I've seen other people do A, B, and C. And that's, I wonder if those things are worth trying as well. And to echo Bill's point, part of what we want to be doing is having the kids feel that they're the experts on themselves and their own lives, but to have them be open to seeking advice and hearing the advice and wisdom of other people who have other perspectives on things. So again, so much of this is not the what, but the how, and a really good consultant will help the kid feel like, you know, a good parent consultant feel like you're working with your kids, not kind of on your kids.
As a consultant, then, what should you do if there's an activity that you really want your kid to pursue, maybe because it's something that you were interested in, or maybe because it's something that you know would look good on a college application, but they really want to give it up?
My first thing, you know, doing something because it looks good on a college application, that's a slippery slope. And I say this as a test prep guy, that I help kids get into college. But, you know, for us, we really think that thinking of high school as a 4-year addition for college doesn't lead to good things. It certainly led to some places right now where most people are pretty unhappy with the college admissions process, as opposed to thinking about these activities in high school as 4 years of developing yourself, figuring out what matters to you, what's important to you, what are you better at than most people, how are you going to contribute to the world? Yeah, but Billy had another idea.
Simply that, you know, one of the ways that we suggest changing the energy in our new book, What Do You Say?, is not trying to force. And I think that if it feels like we're trying to force our kids, something's wrong with this picture, because we really can't make them do anything. And we find that it's so empowering to actually say, you know, I obviously couldn't make you do this. All you'd have to do is just flop on the floor. But I'd love for you to hear my perspective. I think this activity, I loved as a kid, doesn't mean you have to, but I think you might like to do it. And certainly it might help you down the road. You might meet people or open doors for you. I'd love to see you give it a try. And I think so that kind of idea where we talk about them, not we're trying to pressure them. We tell them, I'm not going to try to force you. But I think that then we make a good case. We make the best case we can. And then if they say, I don't really want to do it, then we respect it. If all a kid wants to do is play video games, that's a different story. Then we negotiate what we can live with and what we can't live with. But in terms of a particular activity, we want to make the case. We want to say, you know, as best we can, but we want to give the message that really you're the expert on.
So what do you do if a kid is playing video games nonstop, or if they're overly consumed by a particular hobby or activity, whether it's video games or skateboarding or something that you feel this is taking up more time than it should?
Well, there are a lot of things, but part of it is just to start respectfully. I mean, to try to understand what it is that the kid likes about skateboarding or what the kid likes about video games. In my experience, I've never been successful trying to tell someone why how they're spending their time is a waste of time, and then have them really want to hear my perspective on it. You know, for right now, I mean, it's been a really interesting challenge during COVID, with everything in the world effectively has been on screens, because that's been the only thing that for so many kids and so many activities have been available to us. And to be fair, we have grave concerns about, you know, too much time spent on screens. And we have a whole chapter in our book about the hard ones, talking to kids about sleep and technology. But there are valid reasons why kids, you know, find joy in games, how they can use it in creative ways, not purely consumptive, how they can connect with anyone from their friends to their grandparents to getting extra help on math. And video games, I mean, these things by design have some flaws to them, but they're also super fun. And so if we approach kids by trying to, tell me about this game, you know, play it with them, ask them questions about it, just like, you know, TV shows. If we respect them and how they want to spend their time, we're much more likely to be successful and say, man, I love that you love that game. I do have some concerns though, because it sure looks to me like you're playing it, you know, this many hours, and there's that feel as your dad, I can't really live with that. Can we talk about kind of what a reasonable amount of time is so that you can enjoy this and I don't feel like I'm a bad parent? In the same way that you do this with a spouse, right? You know, who all your spouse wanted to do was play golf. If you ran down golf and this is the biggest waste of time in the world, that doesn't get you closer. But you can say, look, it's a whole lot of time and I really need your help on this, or I miss you on the weekends if you're away the whole time. So much of this, again, is about collaborative problem solving, which includes treating kids respectfully and keeping in mind that we're trying to communicate respectfully with them so that those are the tools they carry in communication to talk respectfully in their workplace, in college, and in future relationships as well.
Our Nobody Told Me conversation continues as we share some information about our sponsor, Green Chef. Green Chef is a CCOF certified meal kit company that makes eating well easy with plans to fit every lifestyle. Green Chef is now owned by HelloFresh, and with a wider array of meal plans to choose from, there's something for everyone.
Whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, vegetarian, gluten-free, or just looking to eat more balanced meals, Green Chef offers a range of recipes to suit your preferences, and Green Chef has expanded its menu. Now choose from more than 30 recipes weekly with the option to mix and match meals from different dietary preferences in the same box without changing your plan. For example, you can order vegan one day and keto the next.
Green Chef is now offering 10-minute lunches. Each week's menu includes two convenient, low-prep, and nutritious lunch recipes, ready in just 10 minutes with no cooking required. They're perfect for when you're on the go or pressed for time at the office.
Make time for exciting new goals this spring with Green Chef's wholesome, elevated recipes. Try fast and fit recipes under 750 calories and ready in less than 10 minutes. Plus, you'll cut down on meal prep with pre-portioned and prepped ingredients, including pre-measured sauces, spices, and dressings.
We are big fans of Green Chef's gluten-free menus featuring meals like cheesy Dijon pork chops with roasted carrots and green beans with almonds.
Also on the gluten-free menu this month is another one of our favorites, pistachio-crusted sockeye salmon. Of course, we have a special offer for Nobody Told Me listeners. Just go to greenchef.com/nobody60 and use code NOBODY60 to get 60% off plus free shipping.
Green Chef is the number one meal kit for eating well.
Just go to greenchef.com/nobody60 and use code NOBODY60 to get 60% off plus free shipping.
Don't a lot of kids respond with saying, you know what, I think you're wrong. I don't think I'm on my screen very much. Thanks for the input.
If I may, there's a story in the book.
Sarcastic.
So there's a story in the book about my son who is ADHD. He's now 19. He's going to the second year in college. And during his sophomore year, the game Fortnite came through our family like a biblical plague. And it was, I mean, it's all he wanted to do and all anyone wanted to do. And I'm watching this and I have some concerns. Now, it wasn't like he abandoned schoolwork and everything else, but I certainly kind of felt like, man, this is a lot of time doing this. So he had a day, and we tell the story in the book, he had a day off of school on a Friday. And Thursday night, I asked him, so what are your plans for the day off tomorrow? He gives me a wry grin and says, play Fortnite. Okay, anything else? I'll think about it. Now, he's a musician, so I would have loved to hear more about that. I come home from work on Friday, maybe 6 o'clock. There's my kid in front of the computer, still playing Fortnite, mind you, in his pajamas. I was a little hot, not going to lie, a little hot. And I look and say, can you finish up that game? Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't take forever. You know, win, lose, I would like to go out for pizza. Oh, yeah. Okay, sure. Oh, and kiddo, can you put on some clothes? Oh, right. So he finishes his game, win or lose, I don't know, don't really care. Gets dressed, we go and have pizza. I simmer down, we have a perfectly lovely meal, and I say nothing more. Saturday, I say nothing more. Sunday, I say nothing more. Until 5 o'clock, which if you have an adolescent boy, you know is really the witching hour, when it occurs to him that the weekend is going to come to an end and that homework that he's not done all weekend is due on Monday. And he's like, oh, I can't believe I wasted the whole day on Friday playing video games. If ever there were a chance to, for a parental, I told you so. That was it. But I was writing this book, so I didn't do that. So I look at him and I say, can I ask you a question? Sure. Do you know roughly how much time you spent playing Fortnite on Friday? I don't know, maybe 10 hours. Wow. Fun? Oh, yeah, it was fun. I won 4 times. Great. But it sounds like you're a little frustrated. If you reflected on it, how many hours do you think might have been sufficient to kind of get your fortnight fix? Maybe 4 or 5? Got it. One more question. Would it be helpful in the future if your mom or I tried to help you manage your use of technology a little bit so you can enjoy it but not feel like you've wasted the whole day? Yeah, I'd appreciate that. So I had waited a long time to get buy-in because without it, we get nothing. I mean, all of us have had the experience of nagging and nagging and nagging, and we're really just nagging kids into submission. But they're not really doing this for the right reasons. They're not hearing us. They're just doing it to get us to pipe down. And that's not the kind of relationship that I want to have with my kid, in part because I knew even when he was then in 10th grade that he was only a couple years before he was heading off to college with fistfuls of mine and my wife's money. And we have no control over what he does with this technology. He can go to college and blow $50,000 and stay up all night playing Xbox. Mm-hmm. Or he can try to use that time while in high school to learn to manage these technologies for himself, which is exactly what he did. And so is it hard to watch your kid squander hours playing video games? Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. But it's also hard to be a kid and learn how to manage these technologies that, if we're honest, we didn't have to fuss with when we were their age. So this is where we're back to being a consultant, working collaboratively, which involves being respectful when we talk to kids about the things we're concerned about.
And that sort of ties in with what you both say, that parents and schools in many cases are often taking away a child's opportunity to grow stronger and more confident. Tell us more about that.
In our first book, The Self-Driven Child, the main thesis is that a sense of control over your own life is one of the best things we could possibly help our kids develop, because a sense of control or autonomy or agency, hugely related to mental health and also completely crucial for motivation. And what we know is that in school, a kid's sense of control, that I can direct my own life, diminishes every year they're in school. And we know that increasingly, you know, kids, as we see these levels of anxiety and depression in children and teenagers and young adults go up, by definition, their sense of control is going down. Because when you're anxious, your thinking's out of control. If you're depressed, forget it. You have no sense of control at all. And so we do think that the culture is moving in a way that needs some course correction here. And we also, one of the things that I thought of what Ned was saying about the fortnight is that in one of the chapters in our book, it's called the Language and Silence of Change. We talk about from something called motivational interviewing, this perspective that this idea that most people are ambivalent about changing. And so if we listen respectfully, if they're playing video games, if they're smoking pot, if we can discipline ourselves to find that, try to understand, what are you getting out of it? How's this working for you? What's likely to happen is they're going to start to bend for their way. Yeah, but I waste way too much time. Or yeah, but it's an awful expensive buying pot. The idea is that if we can seek to understand, and to try to promote the respectfully, this is your life, that it just works out better. And we just talked to dozens and dozens of people over the last 3 years who've read The Self-Driven Child, who said just changing the energy in this way, where I'm not trying to drive the my kid's life. I'm trying to understand, help him understand what he wants and support him. And set limits where I have to, but it just works so much better.
Mental health issues, gosh, it seems like they just spiraled during the pandemic. And I wondered how much of an impact parents being with their kids all the time had on that. And if you saw more that the kids were maybe blaming the parents for not being able to go to school, not being able to go to prom, all those things, even if it was misplaced, was that an issue?
Yeah, I mean, this year was hard for, I mean, every reason you can imagine. But one thing that you know, and I spend my time working with high school students, one of the things that I think was hard was parents had a really intense, ever-present front row view to their kids doing their schoolwork, or just more likely not doing their schoolwork. And it's hard. Because if you have a kid who puts off his work and procrastinates, and but he does that when you're not seeing it at school and out of sight, out of mind, you don't have to worry about this. But if you had a kid who was not doing his work, or she was struggling with his work, or you know, and her grades were failing or whatever, as a parent, you feel like it's somehow you have to fix this. And it's hard, it's stressful, it's terrifying, in part because you can't make a kid do their work if they just really don't want to do it. And the attempts to do that, it puts parents in a very position where their sense of control is impossibly low. You know, I have to get my kid to do this, but I can't make him do it. No wonder they were stressed. And school was harder for a lot of kids across the board. You think, oh my gosh, you know, my kid was destined for Harvard, right? And now they've gotten these terrible grades and they're not even going to make it to a local community college. All of those things are really, really stressful. But we, you know, one of the things we also know is that two things. One, we have a chapter in the book about the language of a non-anxious presence. And it's simply an idea that when we are more calm, when we are better able to put things in perspective, that energy affects our kids and it makes them helps them be more calm and more able to put things into perspective. So when our kids are having a hard time, because we love them and care about them, we tend to get upset as well. And if we can remind ourselves that we can be helpful by doing just the opposite. I mean, the Navy SEALs, for goodness sakes, remind us that calm is contagious. And that's easier for some people to do, harder for some others. But we have a whole chapter talking about this. How do we communicate to kids the idea that the world is mostly safe most of the time? And that even if things are really, really bumpy right now, that there are all kinds of ways where you can still build the life and have a life that you want to live, even though it's rocky right now. And if we as parents can hold to that idea, we're much more credible in conveying those messages to our kids as well.
Is it your sense that the pandemic brought families closer together and opened up communication between kids and parents, or was everybody so stressed out that that didn't happen?
I think that in my experience, most of my clients, most people I'm in touch with are middle class, upper middle class. So I have a kind of a slice of the population. And for mainly, I think many families, I'd say most of the families that I work with, felt that it really did bring them closer together. And you know, partly many of the kids that I see actually did better. I mean, certainly the pandemic exacerbated this mental health crisis. But we certainly, for some families, just being able to sleep in, to just being able to get up at 8:30 instead of 6:30, made a huge difference for parents and kids spending time together. We know many families who, for the first time, the kids actually spend quite a bit of time with their dads. And it's our experience has been, at least mine, has been a very mixed bag in that for some families, the financial stresses, the social isolation was devastating. Other families, I think they really did grow closer.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is, you know, how did you use your time and attention? I mean, you know, did you sit there, well, this is a hard year for us and we're making this money, but you know what? We get to have dinner together all these days when I normally be at work. This is my experience as a test prep guy, not a banner year for the kind of work that I do. Where other families, you know, if all you're obsessing about is how, you know, everything that's going poorly, you know, then you're investing your energy in ways. And if you're focused on all the things that are going poorly, you can make yourself nuts. If you can focus on the things that are the silver linings, even though they're few and far between, you could feel that this was a year that wow, I really became a lot closer to my kid because I had that time and those opportunities to connect.
I feel like when I think of parent-child relationships, it's pretty much in extremes. And you have mother-daughters who are super close, like me and my mom.
Do a podcast. Do
a podcast together.
Yeah. And then go guys, good team.
And then you have these parent-child relationships where it's just really toxic. How much information should parents share with their kids, and how close should they try to be with their kids?
Should you be your kid's best friend?
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, David Brooks had an article in New York Times last week on the unraveling of the American family. And just a shockingly high percentage of people are estranged from their parents. Something like 27% of adults are estranged from their parents, which is partly this kind of idea. We want to build closeness with our, but on the other hand, also said that the surprisingly number of parents, the goal is to be their kid's best friend. And for many families, I think for the two of you, you may have grown together as adults and you can be like each other's best friend. I think it doesn't, as kids are growing up, I think that you really can't, if you're confiding in with your kid like a best friend, that puts a lot on the kid. And if the kid doesn't have peers that they feel close to confiding in, only my parents, from a social development point of view, that doesn't go as well. So I like it when adult parents and kids are really close. And we want to stay close to our kids, but I think as they're growing up, having a parent-child relationship, a close parent-child relationship where we remain the parent as opposed to kind of a friend is probably the best way to do it. Does that make sense to you too?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I never felt that I was your best friend when you were growing up. I mean, I feel we're friends now, but yeah. I always wanted to be mom because nobody else can fill that role. You can have lots of best friends.
Yeah, and the dynamic changes once you become an adult.
Yeah. Oh, of course it does. Yeah. Sure.
Right. Well, that's an excellent point, you know, and one of the things we've been talking about, you know, past few weeks and months, we've been talking about what's in this book is really the observation that if things go right, parents will have a longer relationship with their children as adults than they will with their children as children. And so it's never too early to really start thinking about that and talking with our kids in ways that are respectful. I mean, because, you know, my kids, anyone's kids, you know, once they graduate college and thanks, mom, I'm good. And they could peace out, as David Brooks talks in this piece, and say, you know, see ya. And we see that when you get parents who are, well, the relationship isn't what we want it to be, as opposed to talking in really ways respectful, knowing that this kid is going to transition into an adult. And I want to have this ongoing, warm, connected, respectful relationship in just the way that sounds like the two of you do. That's a beautiful thing for all of us to aim towards. But that seems to me that is doing it in a way that I have advice to share, but I'm not the boss of you. I'm not the only one. I don't know better how to run your life than you do.
How important are things like family rituals and family routines to keeping communication lines open? If everybody makes a point of having dinner together, for example, is that helpful?
Super helpful for people to have predictability in their lives, you know, that I know I'm going to have this, you know, this problem. I know this time I can bring this up with mom when we do our Saturday, Sunday afternoon walks or whatever happens to be, you know, the predictability of sitting down and an unrushed time with our family across the dinner table, super valuable. And, you know, I have great friends who every Sunday night is pizza night, right? Just to have things to look forward to that are mutually fun. Not I'm, you know, on top of got your homework every night, but to look forward to shared activities that are mutually enjoyable binds us together as families in you know, mutual enjoyment of the activity and of each other.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so much research on just how much better kids do if families can have family dinners a few times a week. And I think part of the message you give a kid when we create a ritual, you know, that we have Friday night is movie night or pizza night, or we this is what we do at Christmas, is we say that we're all in this together and you're an important part of our family. And that this ritual is important in part because you're in it. And I think that having consistency, having some, not that it has to be rigid, but routine, we talk about family rituals in the first chapter in our book about this, about getting connected with kids and staying connected, because as they get older, we look for ways to stay connected. And one of them is family rituals and finding things in common. But with my kids, I decided I need an hour a week with each one of you, just one-on-one, because that's the way you really get to know somebody. That's the way you stay connected. So both my children, from the time that they are probably 4 or 5 till they left home, every Sunday, I spent an hour a week alone with each one of them, doing something that was just, you know, enjoyable for both of us, just to have Nessie's, this is really important. You're important to me.
listening is one of the skills that just suits you so well, does so well for you as an adult. And that seems like a skill that a lot of kids don't have. So how can you teach your kid to be a good listener?
By listening to them. I mean, it's you know, so much of what our kids pick up from us is not our words, but by what they see us model. You know, we start the book talking about the real power of listening. And a quick tool for people, if they're like, how do I do that better, is what's called reflective listening, which is really a core attribute of therapy. There's a wonderful guy named Ron McGinn who used the acronym WIGGING. And WIGGING stands for what I got is. And so this is if your son or daughter brings to you a problem, they're upset, they didn't get the grade, they weren't treated fairly, their brother is a pain in the neck, whatever. And you simply repeat back as best you can. So let me repeat that back. So what I hear is that you feel like the teacher really didn't grade that test fairly, right? If we get this right, you feel like your sister is just doing everything she can to actually drive you crazy. Do I have that about right? And note that I'm not agreeing. I'm simply reflecting it back to say, I hear you. And I see that there's something valid to how you, what you feel about this. And this act of listening, then feeling heard and understood is the single best way to calm other people's hard emotions. We, as parents, we have what's called a writing reflex. And when we hear a problem, we want to, you should do this, you should do that. We want to start solving that problem. But oftentimes, we all have had this experience, people get defensive and they start fighting the really good advice we have to give. And if we start with listening, including this reflective listening, it lowers the emotional charge. It makes the other person feel heard and understood, and it makes them much more likely to be open to the advice that we then would like to share with them.
We always ask our guests at the end of each episode, what is your nobody told me lesson? So what is it that nobody told you about talking with kids that you kind of had to learn on your own and that you would love to pass on to other people because you feel it's very important?
For me, I took a chapter of our book, this chapter on the language of a parent consultant. We focused on getting buy-in. And the idea is being that rather than telling kids 10 times or increasing the volume every time, you know, that you say, I've got an idea about that. Are you open to hearing what I'm saying? And I think nobody told me that it doesn't work to tell the kid the same thing over and over again. You know, I keep trying to make him see that kind of thing. And I think that that would have helped me early on. If kids were younger, had I known that kind of to save my breath at times.
And I would add, in our book, we look on the research of what's called motivational interviewing, which was first used with alcoholics. And what was found was that talking it out, traditionally, you list off all the reasons you're going to lose your health, your job, your spouse, your whatever. And like that, all those reasons would change people's behavior. And it didn't do it, in part because all of us are ambivalent about change. And so what happens when we argue one side of the equation, people argue the other side of the equation. We're just talking with a friend whose daughter is a senior in high school, and she's pretty perfectionistic. She's really driven for top schools. And her mom keeps trying to tell her, you know, but you don't have to. And the more she tells her that she doesn't have to go to a highly selective school, she doesn't have to get perfect grades, the more the girl argues the other side. And so if we understand that there's that kind of seesaw effect, that the more we push on one side, the more kids push on the other, we realize, as Bill is saying, that we can maybe save our breath and talk to kids in ways that are more effective, which might include something like, gosh, if we go back to this reflective listening, it sure sounds like you're under a lot of pressure to get perfect grades on everything. Boy, that must be really hard, right? It makes the kid more likely to be able to say, well, it's probably not true that I have to be perfect. I mean, I still want to get A's, but it doesn't have to be 100%. And so it puts kids in the position of hanging in that place of ambivalence and really being much more likely to weigh the pros and cons. And in a perfect world, moving in a direction that's a little bit more sane. But when we try to talk people out of things, they actually cling to it more tenaciously. And if I'd known that, I have a daughter who is. She's got at least 20 IQ points. I mean, she's really sharp cookie and she's pretty rigid. And even when she was a little kid, I thought I could out-argue her. I could talk her into believing my perspective. And it took quite, eventually dawned on me, this ain't working, right? This is not working. So for anyone who's listening to this and picks up the book, I sure go right to that chapter, read about that part, and you can save yourself some of the anguish that I've learned from the hard way.
Well, we thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. And I think we've really gotten a lot of great information out of you. So we thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You guys are great.
Yeah.
No, this was so much fun. And I have to say, we've done a lot of shows on parenting, and I think you guys just have it spot on.
Yeah. you really nailed it. This is a 30-minute course to parenting. It's great. But again, well, our thanks to William Stixrud and Ned Johnson, whose latest book is called What Do You Say? How to Talk with the Kids to Build Motivation, Stress Tolerance, and a Happy Home. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be right back.